Okay, so this is just going to be a Blackboard talk, so this is very informal, and this is really just work in progress. I'm afraid that what I tell you that is interesting won't be useful, and what I tell you that might be useful will not be interesting. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit about some of the issues involved in... polarization and magnetization, which most of us teach to our second year students or something in electromagnetic theory, and talk about a dipole moment per unit volume and magnetic dipole moment per unit volume and so on. And that's all sort of reasonably well defined if one thinks of one's material as being made up of units where the charges are linked in fixed stable units, like a rare gas solid or some molecular solids or something like that. But the issue I want to talk about is what happens if you talk about a solid, say at a more realistic level, where maybe you introduce block states and so on, and you don't have stable units. How do you talk about things like magnetization and polarization? How might you make sense of that? So, what about solids? In particular, periodic solids, but solids in general. And, of course, the sort of modern way one thinks about it is what some people have called the modern theory of polarization. So let me just remind you, this is work done in the early 90s, or started in the early 90s, by people like Resta and Vanderbilt and others. Okay, and they began, their focus was mainly on insulators. And most of the work has really been done, most of the work they've done has really been at the independent particle level. Some of it at cone-sham level, but most of it, you know, sort of simpler than that. But they started out with the observation that it's difficult how you think about polarization in a periodic solid, because you might have a charge distribution like this. And then it seems fairly obvious that the dipole moment of a unit cell is this. And then you have your dipole moment per unit volume by adding those up per unit volume. But of course, the difficulty is that there are many ways you can set up your unit cell. You might set up your unit cell like this, and then your dipole moment looks like that. Okay, so there's an ambiguity in how you define a dipole moment per unit volume. And they argued that if you really think about things, what's important is not the dipole moment per unit volume, but sort of its change. So they thought of a situation where you maybe have a capacitor plate, you maybe turn on a voltage, close a switch, and then what there really is a current. Okay, it's a current that flows from one to the other, and what's really physically important is not P, but dP dt. Okay, in this kind of a situation. And by a host of arguments, they then went through and showed that you can, that the one way to do things is to associate in an insulator anyway the polarization with the dipole moment of the Vanier function. And that, in fact, turns out to be independent of the phases as in your block states and so on. And the changes of this is a good description of the current you would see in a near equilibrium situation like that. So that the status of this is reasonably well understood. And people are now generalizing it to look at magnetism. Okay. Question? Yeah.
So are the cases of interest here those in which the divergence of P is non-zero? I presume if you only have surface charges, it's sort of...
Right. That's right, and there are lots of issues. I mean, this kind of approach is really focused on uniform material, and they've really focused on a situation very much like this. Okay, that's either equilibrium or very close to equilibrium. Okay, and this has not been applied to inhomogeneous polarizations, for example. This kind of approach. That's something I'm going to get to. Okay.
Because of conventional inconvenience. Computational inconvenience.
No, not really. It's really not formulated properly for inhomogeneous materials. Okay, there is no formulation that I'm aware of for an along these lines, for an inhomogeneous polarization.
So then, homogeneous ones, I think it's very questionable whether it is if you have an electric field applied to an homogeneous system, then you get divergences.
Right, so one has to really think of a finite chunk of material, and one has to sort of do a little bit of tap dancing to justify all of it.
Right, but what you simply do is quantum theory for a finite system, mm-hmm. then apply a magnetic and electric field in that case, and if you forget.
Now, you can't really apply a constant electric field in an infinite system where everything ionizes. Okay, so there are subtleties associated with how you think about these limits. Okay, but usually the way the argument goes here is they imagine a situation where you constrain the occupancy and the number of Wannier functions associated with a given site to be fixed. So you don't allow ionization, as it were, okay? And then you build up your description in terms of things like, at that level, okay?
But what actually, as Paul said, what really gives you the fields are the surface charges.
Yeah, right. And that's right. And there's a flow, and that's precisely why it's the J that's significant, right? Because it's the flow of charge across there, okay? But it's useful to be able to introduce this quantity and calculate it, because you can imagine a situation where you perhaps did not apply a voltage, but where you did something with your Hamiltonian or changed something internally to the system, or there was a phase transition or something. Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, a ferroelectric phase transition or something, where you would want to talk about a dP dt, okay, and you would associate it, of course, with this kind of a current, but you would still want to do a band structure calculation of it without explicitly applying perhaps an electric field.
Right, so it's for computational convenience, not so much. So they want to use their code.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. To calculate something which, in general, that would be more complicated.
But there is no definition in the literature for an inhomogeneous polarization along these lines. Not that I'm aware of. If you find one, let me know.
But what's difficult about that if you have an infinite system? Then it's quite obvious.
It's
then you simply calculate the surface charges in response to an electric field.
If you have a finite system or an infinite?
Finite.
A finite system, aha. But then you have to define what you mean by the polarization, at a given region in the solid. And how are you going to do that?
At the surface, is it also not defined? Is it also not clear? You have always integrated over a wide unit cell.
But what is your unit cell? I have a different polarization depending on what unit cell I pick. Of course. But no one introduces that along these lines. There's no introduction of a microscopic polarization in the literature that I'm aware of. Not there. That's why I'm talking about these things. Okay? Recently, there's been some work on magnetization. Okay, and the same situation, of course, can arise if I imagine I have some current that goes like this, and it seems fairly obvious what my dipole moment per unit volume is supposed to be. I could talk about a dipole moment associated, magnetic dipole moment associated with one of those little unit cells and so on. But of course I could do my unit cells like this. And then I would get the reverse answer, in fact. So there's an ambiguity in terms of how you define magnetization as well for periodic system, in the same way that there's this ambiguity for polarization. Okay?
Only for the orbital magnetization.
That's right, and that's a good point. Okay, there is no problem with the spin mag. What got me interested in these things, in large part, is things having to do with spin, but there is no problem with the spin. Okay? At least there are some technical problems, but no major sort of formulational problems. Okay, it's in fact with the orbital motion that the problem arises, and that's what I'm going to be talking about. Okay. So the suggestion has been made here that you should identify a magnetization as the magnetic dipole moment of the Vanier function. And that, in fact, you cannot do. Okay, that will not work. And the reason that won't work has been sort of recently discussed in the literature. And you have to worry about the fact that you can have current flowing through Vanier functions from other Vanier functions. And in fact, you have to add a surface current. If you think about a chunk of material and want to consistently talk about the magnetization. And I don't want to talk about that here, but there's a recent FISREV letter by Vanderbilt, Resta, and co-workers, and a more recent ConMat thing that came out about 3 months ago that generalizes it a little bit and talks about that approach. Okay? So all the work that I'm aware of along these lines, okay, is essentially time-independent systems. Okay. There has been some heuristic generalization to time-dependent problems, but very heuristic. And it's focused on macroscopically homogeneous systems. Okay. I'm not aware of anything along these lines from this sort of school that does things more generally. Okay. So there are a number of problems. I come from a background of looking at things in optics, so I want to look at optics, right? I want to look at optical problems, injecting things, and so on. Well, this is pretty. Well, this doesn't work, right? I don't know how to do this for optics. Okay. It turns out there is and has been around for a number of years. Some heuristics that's associated with names of people like Adams and Blount that's basically work done in the early 60s. Okay. And what they assert is that you should, for the polarization, you should just pretend you're doing atomic physics. Okay. And introduce a dipole moment. And then you want to take matrix elements of that dipole moment between your states. That's what you would do if you were doing atomic physics. Okay? But now you have to take matrix elements of this thing in block states. Okay? Which is a little problematic because the block states go on forever. How do you take the matrix element of something like X? Okay? But there's a well-defined set of heuristics that they developed that gives you a prescription for how to do this. Okay. And you can argue that it's maybe not as rigorous as you would like, but it is true that if you just follow this through and use this as your definition of polarization, and use this to formulate what you mean by polarization, you will get the same result as the modern theory of polarization. And for magnetization, you will get exactly the same result as this recent work. And it is one of the things that annoys me that these people never reference these people. I don't understand why they don't do that. I mean,
you ever talk to them about it?
Yes.
What do they say?
Well, we're doing it better and so on and so on. Well, fair enough. Of course one wants to do that. But on the other hand, when the formulas exist in the literature and people have been using them for some time to make calculations, it seems unwise not to reference them.
Doesn't that define friendship in physics?
Well, perhaps. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I mean, for all I know, these people may be dead. I mean, it could be that... No, I'm going to do something totally different. Okay? Yeah, what you do here is you use... it's essentially... What would you expect for this? If you had plane waves, if you just had plane waves, this is the matrix element of x between eigenstates of momentum, right? And you would get basically d by dk, I d by dk prime of delta k prime minus k. Okay? But then, of course, these are block functions, so life is more difficult. And what you get is this, what I call Lax's connections, because I learned them from Lax. Okay, these are the things that tell you how the gradient of the periodic part of the block function varies as you move through the Brillouin zone. Okay? So there's a very well-defined heuristics. Works really well. You have to be careful when you use it.
That thing is gauge-dependent, I guess, is
it? This thing is gauge-dependent, but when you use this with the set of operators, the gauge dependence of the operators cancels out the gauge dependence of this, so all your results are gauge independent. Okay. Works beautifully. I've made a number of calculations with it. There's a whole literature of quantum chemists who make calculations with this. Okay. And you can...
Sort of an experimental question. I mean, if I just started from... If you asked me to calculate some optical transitions, and my experimentalist brain would just try and use KRP theory,
right, exactly. The problem with K, you could use K dot P, and you'd get the right answer, of course, but there's a problem with K dot P. Okay, and that is the following. Suppose I want to calculate with K dot P something like the current response. Okay, then what I have to do is I have to calculate the expectation value of this when I use K dot P. Okay, now, this, and let's say I do it to first order. Okay. If I do it to first order, I calculate a response for this, but I just take this to be what it is. Okay, that's first order in my field. Okay, but that's an A. Okay, which means if I write it in terms of E, it's an E over omega. Okay, so that means that it looks as if the current is diverging as omega goes to zero. If you write it in terms of E, right? Okay, and this is okay, but it's not. Okay, it's not, because when you work out this piece, there are pieces here that cancel this divergence. Okay, so you will always get the right answer if you use P dot A. Okay, you will never run amok. But there are technical problems in doing a P dot A calculation, in that you get divergences, you get false divergences, as it were, in different parts of the problem. If you use all the correct sum rules, they go away. But if you're doing some nonlinear response, you're doing a chi-3 calculation or something, right, a third order in the electric field, there's a lot of sum rules to keep track of. So P dot A is just inconvenient for a lot of optical calculations. Inconvenient. So that's the motive, a large part of the motivation of going over to this kind of approach. Okay. Well, I want to do something different here. So I want to look at time-dependent problems. I want to look at inhomogeneous problems. So I want to introduce a polarization and a magnetization, the way one normally introduces them, like that. Okay. For general time-dependent rho and j, I want to introduce P and M that are going to make some sense and be useful. And I want this to talk about all the electrons, not just the bound electrons, because in a semiconductor, if I'm optically injecting electrons, there's no well-defined separation between bound and free electrons. Okay? So the question is to explore what one can do with this in a very general way. Okay? And all I'm going to do is a little bit of that today, less than I thought. Okay, so the first point is, of course, one way to think about this is that P and M are potentials. The physically significant things are rho and j, and P and M give you ways to write rho and j. Okay? And just like other potentials, there's a certain gauge freedom. There is no unique P and M that will work. Okay? If I have a P and M that works, a P prime that's P plus the curl of some function, and an M prime that's M minus 1 over C times the derivative of that function plus the gradient of the scalar function will still satisfy these equations. Right?
So that, talking about orbital magnetization only here?
Yeah, sorry, I said that before you came in. There is no problem of this sort with spin magnetization. So that can be added on to the game later, okay? Okay, so why do I want to do this? Well, I've already given you one motivation. I'll give you some others, but one motivation is periodic solids. And I'll talk about others. Okay, and I'm going to talk about some, since these are unique, one's going to be asking, what can one do? So one might want to come up with some desiderata for, you know, what one would like for the P and the M that one would like to choose. And I'm going to build that list up by giving you some examples and showing you what's wrong with them and why we don't want certain aspects. Okay? So the first point to make is that you can ask, well, all right, suppose you give me a rho and a j. How easy is it to find a P and an M? Okay, this is now an abstract question, independent of condensed matter physics or anything like that. You know, you're just given a rho and j. How easy is it to find a P and M? And the thing is, it's very easy to find a P and M that do the trick there. And I can illustrate that by writing two of the Maxwell equations in a strange way. Okay, so those are just two of the Maxwell equations. So if I want, I can think of the electric field and a magnetic field that a particular charge current density generate as the polarization and the magnetization in terms of which I can write that charge current density. But that's not a very interesting or useful thing to do. Okay? Why? Well, because I want to use, I mean, the idea here is that I use a P and M to describe a rho and a j. Okay? And what that means is I want, from doing quantum mechanics, I want the P and M to be in the same Hilbert space as rho and j. Okay? So more generally, we sort of want a P at a given position and time, I would want this to depend on rho at perhaps different positions, but at the same time, and j at different positions in the same time, and similarly for m. That would be a useful thing. If you think of a quantum mechanical problem, then these guys would be in the same Hilbert space as these guys, and these guys could help you describe these guys, which is what you're after. Okay? So I'm going to call those time local and direct. And I'll explain what I mean by direct later. It's clear what I mean by time local. I'm just asking for fields such that this dependence just depends on these things at the same time. Okay? So again, I'm just exploring electrodynamics here, right? Let's say I put that as a desiderata. What can I learn? Okay, well, you can get a restriction right away if you're after that kind of description. And let me illustrate that by considering a single classical charge. So let's consider just a single classical charge with a Q and a Q dot. Okay. Then what this kind of prescription says is that I want P to depend on X and maybe Q and Q dot, and M to depend on maybe X and Q dot. And you would tend to think that the time dependence of this would be through the time dependence of Q and Q dot. There may be some additional time dependence you may want to introduce, but let me just start with this. Okay, the argument that I'm going to make, still, the restriction still arises if you allow for independent time dependence of P and M. Okay? And the argument that you get is by just assuming that form and then looking at the second of these equations. Okay? And if you write it out, what do you get? You get C curl M of X Q Q dot equals J, which depends on X and Q dot, of course, if I have a single charge. And then minus dP dt, and that's going to be dP dQ dot times Q dot minus dP dQ double dot. DP dQ, dQ dot, dP dQ dot, Q double dot, and Q double dot is E over M, E plus, E over M, Q dot over C cross B, Q. And now you see a problem. Because I want to hold that condition. And I'm allowed to set Q, Q dot, E, and B at t equals 0. The problem is this side of the equation just depends on Q and Q dot. Okay? So if it worked for a given E and B, I could choose another E and B at my initial condition for which it didn't work. So if you're after this kind of an approach, what you learn is that, I think, this thing must be zero. Okay. So I can at most, if I'm in this regime of this kind of time local direct model, then I want a P that just at most depends on Q, and an M that in general can depend on Q and Q dot. Okay. And that jives with what you would want, because if you think about how one is going to try to use these, if I have some, again, just doing a classical particle, I have a Lagrangian and I want to get things in terms of some sort of polarization and magnetization, then I replace this by a different Lagrangian that depends by the total derivative. And the trick, as you've all seen, is to choose F to be this. And if you choose that F, take the total derivative, your new Lagrangian is essentially the kinetic energy term plus now my polarization plus my magnetization. Right, and that's what one wants to do. Okay. So one exchanges the gauge freedom in E and B, or in A and phi, for gauge freedom in P and M. Okay. And that's how one typically uses these polarizations and magnetizations in dynamical problems. Okay. And that brings up another motivation, and that is, suppose I want to study propagation of wave packets in fields. Okay. Well, my experimental colleagues don't tell me what they apply in terms of phi and A. They tell me in terms of E and B. And they say it's a uniform field or almost a uniform field of this sort. So there's an advantage in terms of writing things in terms of E and B. One does spin orbit interaction. One wants to see the analog of spin orbit forces in terms of how they're behaving like a B. So for the translational motion, one would like to be able to phrase it all in E and B. Here I just think of a classical charge, and so the E and B are the applied field. In different cases, it's different things. Okay, so if I now switch to more general notation than just a single charged particle, that means I want a polarization that depends somehow through some function, let me call it S, on the charge density. Because it can't depend on Q dot, it can only depend on charge density. And what you might try is a magnetization that just depends on the current density through some parameter alpha of x and y. Like that.
So it's now non-local?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Non-local in space, local in time, because the same time here is the same time here. Okay. So this you need if you're going to build one of these what I call time local direct sort of polarizations and magnetizations. And this we're just going to try. I'll show you a lot, but there are lots of P's and M's that fit in this category anyway. And let me just mention that, you know, you can't satisfy, you know, you want this to satisfy, you know, this is supposed to work, right? These two equations are supposed to work as well. Okay. And that requires essentially two conditions on this. And I'll just write them down because I'm going to generalize them in a minute. So those are the conditions that define this kind of theory. This kind of theory is too strong a word. This kind of way of specifying the P and M that I'm trying to construct in terms of my rho and J. You find functions S and alpha that satisfy that, and you're done. Okay. Okay. Let me give you an example of one that works. This is a sort of strange one, or you might think it's a strange one. Let's say I have an arbitrary charge current distribution. And let me pretend if electrostatics were true, I could construct the electrostatic field that would follow from that charge current distribution. Let me call that E electrostatic. And I could construct the magnetostatic magnetic field that would follow from that charged current distribution. Okay? Those are not the correct E and B fields that these charged current this charged current distribution generates, but I can write them down. Now it's interesting to ask your students, how well do those approximate fields satisfy Maxwell's equations? They obviously don't satisfy Maxwell's equations because they're not the correct fields. But the remarkable thing, or the thing that I found remarkable, is they exactly satisfy three of the Maxwell equations. Exactly. They exactly satisfy the divergence of B. That's fairly trivial because the divergence of a magnetostatic field is zero. But they also satisfy these other two equations. That one's trivial. The other one's not so trivial, but it turns out they exactly satisfy those two equations. Exactly. Okay. Only Faraday's law they don't satisfy. Okay. So what that means is, now the electrostatic field and the magnetostatic field do just depend on the position and the velocity of the charge at a given time. Okay. So unlike these fields, the exact ones, which are not of this category, these are. So I can take my pole. Let's again go back to the simple case of a single classical charge. I can take the polarization to be this. Notice it just depends on Q and not Q dot. And the magnetization to be this, depending on both Q and Q dot. Okay. Very non-local things, right? Okay. Charge is here, it has given velocity, but these particular polarizations and magnetizations exist over all space. And if you think about it, you have to have something like that. And that's part of the problem of this problem. Okay? If you look at the Hamiltonian, let's say I start with my initial Hamiltonian, P minus E over CA. And then do the canonical transformation or the unitary transformation that corresponds to this to go over to P and M. And what you find is you get a term from the magnetization that looks like this, and then there's a P of xt dot E of xt. And this is hugely non-local. Here's P, here's Q, okay? So everything's well, Q lives in here. Okay, so my H depends on P and Q in the applied field. But notice this depends on B everywhere. And it has to, because of the Ehrenhof-Bohm effect. Okay? If I have an electron somewhere over here, and there's a magnetic field over here, this electron has to know about it. It's not going to affect its Lorentz force law, but if I write down the quantum mechanics of this, it is going to modify the phase. In the normal formulation, that sits here because the potential extends out to where the charge is, but the magnetic field doesn't. But the electron still has to know about this. Okay? And the way the equations make that work is through a very non-local dependence on B. Okay, and this plague of this Ehrenhof, not plague, but you know, this Ehrenhof-Bohm effect, the fact that the charge out here has to know about a field here, means, I think, that a kind of non-local dependence on applied fields, if I look for a Hamiltonian that just depends on E and B and not A and phi, is going to be inevitable. Okay. So this was talked about in many years ago. That's the reference for that. Okay. So, Do we like this Hamiltonian? Do we like this particular choice of P and M? No. Okay? There are a large number of reasons. Well, one reason is that it's very unforgiving. Okay? I mean, to get to this, you have to do all kinds of partial integrations and neglect things in infinity. All right? And you want hopes that those approximate, those things are not going to come back and bite you later on. Okay? And you could imagine an electric field here that was a pulse, and that would die off fast enough at infinity. But this P drops off as, you know, as 1 over R squared. Okay? Drops off very, very slowly. Okay? So one's concerned about, you know, so you know, you can get hurt by, you can essentially get hurt by that. So it's unforgiving. It also doesn't separate electric and magnetic effects. I mean, one would like somehow, and this is hard to make precise, I think, but one would like a polarization to somehow describe electric effects and a magnetization to describe magnetic effects. Okay, that's a kind of desiderata. Let me write down one. It has to be forgiving, okay? The other thing is, it has to be, I would like it to correctly separate electric and magnetic effects. You could argue it's hard to define that precisely, what you mean by that, but look how poorly this does. Okay? If I throw away this term by hand, you might expect that if this correctly separated electric and magnetic effects, that if I just threw away this term by hand and used that as a Hamiltonian, I would get mq dot equals E times E. Okay? That's the electric effect. But in fact, if you throw this away and you use this Hamiltonian, you don't get that. You get mq dot equals E times the longitudinal part of the electric field, not the total electric field. And you can see that that has to be because this P is, of course, completely longitudinal. And it only sees, therefore, the longitudinal part of this electric field. Okay. So if I want to use this in optics, I'm toast, right? Because in optics, the applied field is all transverse. Okay? So all the optics interactions, you know, of the charge sit in here, right? That's okay, they can do that, because I can only do this kind of tap dancing if I assume that my E and B are related by the gauge conditions, right? So I have to specify an E and B that satisfy Faraday's law. Okay? But what that means, this is a very bad grouping. This is a very bad choice of P and M, okay? It does not separate out these effects. Okay? All right, what else can one do? Let me show you something that works. Okay. And this is going to be of more use for sort of wave packet evolution, which is where I'm now trying to apply it, than in the case of periodic solids. But nonetheless, I think it's interesting. And I think you've all seen this, but maybe not all seen it in the neat way, in the neatest way it could be done. Okay. So I'm a theorist, I'm allowed to spend my time on neat ways to do things, even if they're not new. Okay. So imagine now, let's look at wave packet studies. Maybe I want to describe a wave packet moving around, okay? And maybe it's scattering off of some center, and I want to describe that, and maybe there's some electric and magnetic fields that are applied, and I want to describe that as well, okay? But I'm going to assume that there's some sort of special point. Maybe it's a scattering center. Maybe it's just a special point that I pick. Okay, I'll choose it to be the origin. Well, if I have a special point, then what comes to mind immediately is the kind of multipole expansion one does in atomic physics, okay, where you introduce polarization and a magnetization in terms of different moments of the charge current distribution. Okay? No reason you couldn't do that here, okay, as well. Okay? So let's think about that. We're going to identify this special point, and I'm now going to generalize my equations here. I'm going to only use the polarization, the way one does in atomic physics, to describe the difference of the charge density from what it would be if all the charge Q were located at my special point. Okay? So that's the addition I'm going to make. And that gives me an addition to my equations for alpha and S. I just get a plus delta of X. That's the addition I get because of this. Okay. So how do we do this now? How do we cleverly make a multipole expansion around here? I'm going to do it, but I'm not going to make the expansion. But I'm going to introduce S's and alphas, and this follows the work that Power did in and a whole bunch of co-workers did in quantum electrodynamics of atoms, and especially Healy, a New Zealand physicist who really fixed up the formalism and corrected a whole bunch of errors that had crept into it. Okay? And let me just give it to you very formally first and then try to put some physics on it, because this is really neat, and I think more people should know this. Okay? In this language, I'm going to introduce a function S of X and Y, and what it's going to be, I'll take my special point and I'll go to some point Y here, and I can choose any path I want from X to Y, from my special point to Y. I choose a curve. And this function is going to be non-zero for X lying along this curve. And what it's going to be is the integral along the curve. If I parameterize the curve by some du, it's going to be dui delta X minus u. Choose any curve you want. And the alpha is a slightly different integral along the curve. Okay, now, so that's what it is, and you can check. You can just plug that in, and you will see that those things indeed satisfy these equations. They work. Okay? Now, all right, what's the physics? Well, let me do, usually what's done, and for good reason, is one just chooses a straight line. Okay? So let's just choose a straight line from my origin to my y point. And then if you write this out in terms of a straight line, in fact, this is the integral from, I'll choose a parameter lambda to take me along the straight line, I get yi delta x minus lambda y. Okay. So lambda goes from 0 to 1. You see, I get a delta function correct. I get a delta function contribution along this line that's a little vector, but not a little vector, a big vector that's pointed from here to y. Okay. You can see what we're doing. We're pulling the charge from the special point up to where it really is. Okay. And indeed, let's look at what this does. Let me do something very scary, but it's fine. I'm going to expand that delta function around x equals 0. Okay? That is, I'm going to expand it around my special point. And if you do that, you see you just get yi delta of x minus a half yi yj d by dxj. Because once I do the expansion, the lambda integral, which I've forgotten here, is trivial. Okay. And if you put that in and calculate what your polarization is, using that particular S, okay, then you get, you can see what you're going to get. from this thing, integrating the charge, you're going to get the dipole moment. In fact, from the next one, you're going to get the quadrupole moment. Okay? So you generate, basically, the multiple expansion, like that. Okay? So this is a way of generating all orders of the multiple expansion. Okay, they all come out. But you don't have to do that. You know, you don't have to expand it. You could just use that expression for alpha. Or you could just use that expansion for alpha, do a whole bunch of manipulations, and then do the expansion later in the game when it's more convenient. Okay. So how does this work when you actually use it? Oh, first of all, let me mention, this is very nice. This is obviously including now all the electric pieces. If you do electrostatics, you get exactly this same multiple expansion. Okay? So this is separating out the electric interaction from the magnetic interaction the kind of way I would like. Okay? So it's satisfying this condition here. Okay? It's also reasonably forgiving when you use it. Okay? Let me just write up, maybe this is worth doing in just a little bit of time here. So let's do it this way. I have now an arbitrarily depending A. And you could add the spin orbit piece if you wanted. It's not going to complicate things very terribly. Okay, what happens now? So I use that S and that alpha without making the expansion. I'm just going to use them exactly. Okay? And I do the canonical transformation or the unitary transformation that's associated with that change in Lagrangian, right? I implement that procedure. And what do I find? Well, I get a new Hamiltonian and a new wave function. I'll use the same letter. And now I get my A is completely gone. Totally expressed in terms of E and B. Okay, I've gotten rid of the gauges. Okay, and this is exact. I've made no approximation here. Right? If I don't do this expansion, okay, I've made no mistake. Okay, made no approximation. Now I can work out this square. And I'm going to get two pieces from this square. Okay, the first one, well, without the B, I'll just call that the kinetic energy term. And then I'll get a piece that I can write as a kind of paramagnetization. That's from one of these with this. And then another term that I can write as a diamagnetization. And then, of course, my electric interaction. And the total magnetization is, in fact, the sum of the paramagnetization and the diamagnetization. Okay, good. So now I've got everything in terms of B and B. I can generalize to spin orbit interaction. I will see another interaction with B. Okay, I can combine that with this, and then talk about the total interaction. You know, with the magnetic field and so on. Okay, I've got a nice story. I've also got a nice story because it turns out that
1/2 there, by the way.
Yes, I did. Because this contains B itself. Okay, so the best way to define this, since it's an induced effect, is with a 1/2, and that guarantees that the total magnetization is the sum of those. And I don't do that by hand, I just work it out and define things that way, and that's what happens. Okay. Now notice that the integral, again, still exact, the integral of this over all space is x. That's the center of the wave packet. Okay. So if I work in this language, I can have an arbitrarily dependent P of x, depending on, you know, how the electric field varies. But at the end of the day, I can get the center of the wave packet by doing this. And this is the angular momentum. Okay, so this is a good way to look at a wave pack. I think this is a good way to look at a wave pack that's evolving and ask general, you know, how does the angular momentum change? How does the position change? These are the kind of questions you want to answer. How is this going to be modified when you introduce spin orbit and you get other interactions with other effective type Bs? Okay. And if you want, you can then make, and if part of your B field is maybe an applied field, that's constant, that's uniform rather, or maybe has a weak gradient, you can then take that into account by doing the expansion later. Okay? You don't have to do it first. Okay? You can do it later, and you can do it when you've got everything in terms of E and B, so you know exactly what you're approximating in terms of what your experimental colleagues are applying in the laboratory, not some A and phi stuff. Okay, so this satisfies perhaps another desiderata. And that is that there's not only an electromagnetic significance to P and M, but there's a purely mechanical significance to P and M as well, or at least they're zero moments. Okay, so. With respect to wave dynamics, well, this way of doing things is pretty good. We're happy here. Okay? Happy face.
Can I ask
Yep.
If you included retardation, this modulus separation would not occur.
No. I'm just talking about here about the interaction of a charge or an electric field theory describing a charge with an applied electric and magnetic field. So, I mean, you could expand this to include the field from the charge itself, but I'm not doing that.
Is there multiple expansion here, so essentially just static?
That's right, but it's correct in general. That is, these equations, before I make the expansion, they're absolutely correct even if these fields are fully retarded. Are fully solutions, if E and B are just full solutions of Maxwell's equations. It's exact. If you do things this way, the multiple expansion you generate with fully time-dependent fields is in fact the same as the one you generate with static fields.
Right, those B and M operators now, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, they're not so nice. What do you want here? Here it is. If I use the straight line, it's going to be yi delta x minus lambda y psi dagger of y psi of y dy. Okay. But you know.
And there, the derivatives, et cetera, using the ordinary current density.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay. But you don't have to expand this, right? You can just go into Fourier space, say, and slap it up in the exponential, do the integral later. Okay. So I'm almost done. I put a happy face here. Okay. With periodic solids, there's a sad face. Okay. And the reason is the following. This whole approach where I have these kind of time local direct polarizations will not work for a periodic solid. And I can prove that to you, I think. I can give you a physicist proof by giving you an example. Okay? And the example is, and I'm a theorist, so I'm allowed to use artificial examples, as long as they don't violate any laws of nature. Okay? So my model, I'm going to consider a chunk of metal, big chunk of metal, that I'm going to say is well modeled by Jellium and a Drude model. Okay? So I know phenomenologically how to describe this. Forget about, you know, funny polarizations and magnetisms. I know what to tell my students to do. You know, they just put in this dielectric constant and off to the races, and they could send a laser pulse in here. And what's going to happen? Well, some of it gets reflected, some of it goes through, propagates for a while, and then eventually dies away. Okay? Imagine this is a big chunk of material. Okay? Now, this is a laser field. The field in here is totally transverse. So the field in here is totally transverse. That means there is no time dependence of the charge density. Complicated spatial dependence because I have a pulse going through. But there is no time dependence of the charge density. And if I have a theory that what I call is time local and direct, that tells me that dp dt will be zero. Because d rho dt here is zero everywhere, except maybe a little bit here. Okay? Because this is a transverse field, but I have to decompose this transverse field into plane waves going in different directions, and I will get a small amount of charge density there. But inside here, rho doesn't change. I just have currents. And that says that dp dt is zero. So if I'm going to build this kind of a description, then that current density has to be described by this. But that's absurd. I could maybe do that, but I'm not interested in that kind of a description. That would be a manifestly silly description, because there's nothing magnetic about that phenomena. Right? I could maybe construct a description like this, but I would have to describe the current density that's here in terms of an M, and that would violate this in really a ridiculous way. Okay? So I don't think there's any way to build a time local direct theory for polarization that would be satisfactory, that physicists would consider satisfactory for even a finite solid, because I haven't assumed this is infinite. This could be just a big chunk of metal. Okay? And I think that's part of the reason why it's very hard to do this kind of general sort of description that I've been talking about, and maybe why it hasn't been done, because you can't do it this way. This way will not work. Okay? How do you do it? Well, you have to do something more general than this. And the road, I think, is clear. What you want to do, is you want to consider P and M, I now think quantum mechanics, okay, as not functionals of rho and J, but I want to think of these as functionals of psi dagger x1, psi x2, let's say. Okay? The single particle product of these operators. Okay? This is more general. I can write rho and j in terms of this, okay? But this is more general than rho and j. This gives me more than rho and j. Okay? But allowing me to do this as to write these as functions of this allows me to give a particular basis significance, and one can therefore move to a basis of Vanier functions, and I think that's the way to formulate the problem, and that in fact connects very nicely with the work that Vanderbilt and Resta have been doing along the lines that I first talked about. I think I can, I'm 95% sure that I can generalize what they've done. I can introduce a polarization and a magnetization that are fully varying through the solid that takes care of the whole, all the electrons. Okay. And I can write as operators. Okay, so I can write them as quantum mechanical operators. I can write a quantum mechanical P and a quantum mechanical M. The difficulty is constructing the Hamiltonian. And I think, and the difficulty I'm having with constructing the Hamiltonian is because it has to respect, obviously, the Ehrenhoff-Bohm effect. So there has to be a huge non-local part in the Hamiltonian. And I have not been able to psych out the exact, or the best, or a reasonable way to do that. Okay? But constructing, but if you make this generalization, which is in fact implicit in the work that these people have done. That's the kind of P and M that they're seeking. It's implicit in their work. And if you proceed in this way, I think you can implement at least this part of the program. And the hope is that ultimately one will be able to find the Hamiltonian as well. But that's, I'm way over time. That's another talk. So thanks very much.
Modern theory of polarization and so on, are they trying to calculate a local polarization or a total polarization?
No, a total polarization for the crystal. That's it. And that's all they try to calculate. Okay. And same with the magnetization. That's all they try to calculate. Okay.
So that's a sort of well-defined thing. We know how to define that, right?
That's right. You can argue about whether there's enough motivation for doing that. I mean, the motivation for P is pretty well defined. It is pretty clear because you can think of this kind of example. How do you think of the motivation for M, right? J is curl M, you know. If I have a uniform solid, there's no J. There is an M. But M is uniform, so its curl is zero. So that M could be anything I want, right? J is zero in a magnet. That, you know, the total J.
The orbital magnetization, total orbital magnetization is well defined, right? And that's the thing.
No. How would you define the total orbital magnetization?
DEdB.
Ah, okay. Then you're okay. If you take that route, if you take a thermodynamic route, yes. Okay. Then one can move along those lines, yeah.
And I think that really all they're trying to do is calculate.
And that's, quite right. That's what, I'm unhappy with that because I don't want to do thermodynamics. I want to do full, honest to goodness, shining laser beams on it and everything, right? But yes, for thermodynamically, the quantity is well defined in that sense, okay? Now, mind you, they have not been able to implement their prescription with a uniform magnetic field. They can so far only implement it with a magnetic field that has the periodicity of the lattice. So they are not there. They are not yet along those lines. Even from a thermodynamic point of view, they are not at the stage yet where the modern theory of polarization is. So I talked about
experimentalists is that. You say experimentalists will use B and E, but theorists are supposed to learn from the Ehrenhoff-Bohm effect that little potentials are the fundamental things. Why should you use E and B?
Well, the potentials aren't the fundamental thing. I mean, it's only gauge invariant aspects of the potential that enter even in Ehrenhoff-Bohm. Right? I can use any gauge I want to describe that solenoid. So it's not the potential that's the fundamental thing, even in quantum mechanics. It's certain gauge invariant aspects of the potential that are important. So I wouldn't quite go that far.
I would say the wave function isn't fundamental because it stays what isn't necessarily significant. It's only when you
quite right.
develop an observable from it.
Quite right. Quite right. I mean, you formulate. If you talk to the quantum information people, they formulate things in terms of rays, not cats, right? The phase doesn't even enter. Right. I do relativistic things. I imagine a solid at rest in the lab. So I'm willing to choose a special reference frame. But quite right. I mean, there's only one reference frame that's obvious if you've got a chunk of material in the lab. There are many gauges that might be obvious. So I'm willing to commit myself to one rather than the other.
This guy gets your attention with the bulking?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's, I mean, there are lots of... I've largely just talked about, you know, sort of one charge and an applied electromagnetic field. So you obviously have to generalize all of this, but the same issues arise, I think. The modern theory of polarization, of course, does not hold for anything other than an insulator. Okay? Even its advocates will claim this is only good for insulators. You know, you have a doped semiconductor, you cannot use this theory. Okay? The kind of more general approach I'm using, or I'm trying to strive for, right, where one can deal with general charge current distributions, then the hope is one could use that for doped systems as well.